Hi everyone, my name is Pallavi. I'm one of the doctors who treat lymphomas and myelomas here at Roswell. So I'm going to give you an overarching overview about these conditions. It's a very, very broad topic, so I'll just try to be more general and just give you a sense of what it is. So what is a lymphoma? Patients ask that all the time because, you know, if somebody has breast cancer, it's easy to explain, or a lung cancer, but like, what is a lymphoma? So what we usually tell them is that lymphomas are cancers of the immune system. Basically, it's a malignant transformation of a lymphocyte. And what is your immune system? It is everything that fights infections or even cancers for you. So lots of moving parts there. So as you can see, there's a big network of lymph nodes which goes from your kind of like your neck down to your groin and even your popliteal fossa behind your kneecaps. And the liver, spleen, skin, bone marrow, your blood, they're all parts of your immune system which can get affected in lymphoma. So why study about lymphoma as PhD students is it's because people like you, scientists, who have really made a difference in the treatment of this condition. The overall survival in 1975 was about 45%. But now, thanks to all the new therapies, which are not just more effective but more but less toxic, the survival has increased to 74%, which is we're able to cure almost 3 out of 4 people with lymphoma, which is, I mean, in the cancer world, it's pretty good. So before understanding lymphomas, you have to know a little bit about the normal development of lymphocytes. So everything starts in the bone marrow. It starts with the hematopoietic stem cell. The hematopoietic stem cell has self-regenerating capacity and also a differentiation capacity. It's called a pluripotent stem cell. That goes on to become the multipotent stem cell, which then goes on to become either the lymphoid precursor or the myeloid precursor. And then from the lymphoid precursor, there originates either B cells, T cells, or NK cells. From the myeloid progenitor, they develop the myeloid series. The dendritic cells are still a little tricky. It's controversial what their origin is, but so that's kind of like here, like in the center right here. So in other words, what happens is that the hematopoietic stem cell makes the lymphoid progenitor, which makes all the lymphoid cells, and the myeloid progenitor makes all the myeloid cells. If there are cancers of the myeloid cells, they are called myeloproliferative disorders. If there are cancers of the lymphoid cells, they are called lymphoproliferative disorders, and that's going to be our focus here today. So basically, it includes CLL, lymphomas, and multiple myeloma. So again, now, as I just said that, you know, there are B cells and T cells, and so there are B cell lymphomas and T cell lymphomas. To again understand more about them, you need to know the stages of normal B cell development. Because the latest theory is that there's a cell of origin theory, which basically says that each cancer cell is basically a frozen B cell. There are like these stages of development, and I'll tell you guys more about it. But the cancer cell just gets frozen in one stage of development, and the biology of the cancer is dictated by the biology of that normal B cell at that phase. So what happens is that in the bone marrow, you have the B cell precursor, and there is a process called VBJ recombination. What it is that for a B cell to become a B cell, they need a B cell receptor. And to make the B cell receptor, there are 3 genes called the VDJ genes, and they keep undergoing kind of like rearrangements to make unique B cell receptors. Why do you need so many B cell receptors? Well, because B cells are supposed to fight infections or just anything that's attacking your body, and there are so many antigens. So you need a big variety of B cells to kind of combat each different antigen. So the B cell receptor is made already in the bone marrow. If the pro-B cell, the B cell precursor, is able to make a good B cell receptor, a functioning B cell receptor, then it becomes a naive B cell. If it's not able to do that, then it undergoes apoptosis. Then the further development of this B cell happens in the lymph node. So B cell, how did the B cell get its name? It's because it was originally described in the Bursa fabricius, which is found in birds. So that's why it's called the B cell, because it was in the Bursa. In the humans, it's in lymphoid organs or lymph nodes. What happens is this B cell, it enters this lymph node in an area called the germinal center. There, it starts undergoing proliferation, like rapid proliferation. One B cell gives thousands of B cells. And what it also undergoes is, so that's called clonal expansion. And then what it also undergoes is something called somatic hypermutation. So it's not just enough to have different types of B cell receptors. These B cell receptors, I know you've had lectures on like genetic mutations and such. So these B cell receptors also undergo point mutations or deletions or duplications to introduce more variety into them. After that is done, each B cell is examined by T helper cells, which test it against different antigens to see if there's a good match between the B cell and the antigen. And only the good B cells which match well with the antigens, which are able to react to the antigen, are kept. If there's a B cell where the mutation didn't really, it's called antigen affinity. If the B cell did not have good antigen affinity, it undergoes apoptosis. Sorry, I'm not doing a good job of this. Let me try this. Oh yeah, it's better. Yeah, so it undergoes apoptosis. So now you have, after this process is over, you have a pool of B cells which are highly sensitized and very, they're kind of like primed for particular antigens. So now these cells can undergo division and they become immunoblasts, which can further differentiate into plasma cells. Or if you don't need them right away, they become something called memory B cells. So the job of the memory B cells is just to travel, either sit in the lymph node or travel to your skin or to your gut where they might encounter antigens and just sit there waiting for that antigen to come to you. Or they could become plasma cells, and plasma cells make antibodies. Like they can just, you know, the antibodies that fight infection for you at any time. So now the cell of origin theory basically says that at each phase there can be a mutation and that can become a cancer. And all these cancers are different from each other. So like, if it was a naive B cell, if that becomes a cancer, it's called CLL, chronic lymphocytic leukemia. In the germinal center, if that B cell becomes a cancer, well, there could be a couple. It could be follicular lymphoma, Burkitt's, diffuse large B cell lymphoma, and such. If it's a memory B cell, here up here, which becomes a cancer, it could be a hairy cell leukemia or a CLL. Or if it's a plasma cell which becomes a cancer cell, then it's multiple myeloma. And so why is this important? It's because this will help you make the diagnosis. These B cells have expression of proteins on their surface, which are retained by the cancer cells. So if you knew which protein is expressed by the normal B cell, you could actually test it out on your unknown cancer cell and tell, hey, this is that cancer, basically. The other thing also is the biology of the cancer is dictated by where it came from, meaning, now these memory B cells, they are just supposed to sit there, like they don't really proliferate. So these cancers, the cancers that come from the memory B cell, are usually pretty indolent, like they're slow growing, you know, they kind of mimic what the B cell was supposed to do. Similarly, like in the plasma cell, if the plasma cell becomes myeloma, the plasma cell was supposed to make antibodies, so the myeloma makes not good antibodies, but kind of like misformed antibodies. Like, so you can actually detect it in the blood, and that's how you can monitor these patients. So it's very important to know what the origin of these cancers was. So basically, the summary kind of is that, you know, if it was a pro-B cell, if the cancer started in the bone marrow, you're going to get a leukemia, like a B lymphoblastic leukemia, which is very aggressive because it is immature cells. If it's a mature cell, it can give rise to like lymphomas in general, and if it's a plasma cell, it can give rise to like multiple myeloma. And this is exactly what I was talking about, is these B cells, they express these antigens on their surface at different phases of development, and you can use exactly these antigens to actually define what kind of cancer you have. For example, if you have a myeloma, it mimics the plasma cell. So the myeloma is negative for CD20, usually, negative for other B cell markers, but it is positive for CD38, so you know it's a myeloma. If it's a cancer cell which is positive for CD20, you automatically know it's coming, it's a B cell lymphoma, basically. So it's kind of used like as a cheat sheet by pathologists to make the diagnosis. The other more interesting thing is you can target these surface proteins. So if you have a monoclonal antibody which attacks CD20, you can potentially use it against B-cell lymphomas because they are all going to die from that. And which is exactly what we do. We use something called rituximab, which is used for, it is standard of care for treatment of B-cell lymphomas. So now, coming to T-cell lymphomas. T-cell lymphomas are a little more complicated because we really don't understand T-cell development as well as we do B-cell development. Why are T-cells called T-cells? That's because they differentiate and mature in the thymus, starting with T. So again, everything starts in the bone marrow. You have the hematopoietic stem cell, which becomes the common lymphoid progenitor, which forms the early T-cell progenitor. So T-cells are defined by T-cell receptors. So T-cell receptors, early T-cell progenitor does not have the T-cell receptor. What happens is that they have to go through a few phases before they develop a pre-T-cell receptor, which then develops a fully formed T-cell receptor. During these phases, the T-cell is called a double negative T-cell. What double negative means is that they're negative for CD4 and CD8. Slowly, they become something called a double positive T-cell, which is positive for CD4 and CD8. And then by the time they're fully mature and they come out of the thymus, they are only single positive, meaning they have either CD4 or CD8. And again, why this is important is because they have different functions. CD4 positive cells are usually helper T cells, whereas CD8 positive cells are usually cytotoxic T cells. Now, these T cells, they have something called the alpha beta T cell receptor, and they are 95% of T cells in your body are these T cells, which are coming out over here. There is a small subset of T cells which are called gamma delta T cells, which are pretty uncommon. They can also give rise to lymphomas, and it's very important to know where the lymphoma is coming from because the biology of the lymphoma is very different. And I'll show you why. So again, what I'm basically saying is that if you have a pro-thymocyte or a pro-T cell, if that becomes a cancer, then you get a leukemia, T lymphoblastic leukemia, totally different beast, very aggressive. If the T cell is coming from, if the lymphoma is coming from a mature T cell, then you can have all these different types. If they are coming from the gamma delta T cells, then you can have hepatosplenic or cutaneous gamma delta T cell lymphoma. And they are a little different from the other T cell lymphomas in the fact that they are more aggressive. So the gamma delta T cells and the NK T cells form part of the innate immune system. And they rarely give rise to lymphomas. And those lymphomas are usually very aggressive. They are more extranodal because these T cells, you know, the innate immune system, why is it called innate? Because it doesn't have to be pre-sensitized to an antigen. So it's your first line of defense. So those T cells are found more in your skin, again in your gut. So that's why these lymphomas are mainly extranodal, whereas the other T cell lymphomas are mainly nodal. So, you know, it kind of gives you a hint of how the lymphoma is going to behave. And again, same thing. You can use these markers to define what kind of lymphoma it is based on where it came from. If you notice, if it's a single digit CD marker, that usually corresponds to T cells. And if it's in the 20s, it usually corresponds to B cells. So that's a quick cheat method to remember if it's a B cell marker or a T cell marker. All right. So now we talked about, you know, the cell of origin, that this is a normal B or T cell and this is a lymphoma. But how do they become cancer? So what are the transforming events? The transforming events are basically, most commonly, are reciprocal chromosomal translocations. So what happens is that you have an oncogene and you have the immunoglobulin gene. The immunoglobulin gene, when it comes in contact with the oncogene becomes constitutively activated. It's active all the time, and that gives the cell an edge to keep proliferating and keep dividing without any growth signals, and it becomes a cancer. That's the most common mechanism, and I'm going to show you in the next slide what the most characteristic translocations are. But other than that, you know, like in any other cancer, you can have mutations in tumor suppressor genes. Most common is P53. You could have genomic amplifications. You can have other translocations which are not involving the immunoglobulin locus, or viruses. So one of the biggest drivers in lymphomas is Epstein-Barr virus. The other common viruses that are implicated are HTLV virus, HHV8 virus, which cause very specific lymphomas. So some of the most common genetic alterations are translocation of 14 and 18, which brings the BCL2 anti-apoptotic gene in contact with IGH. which is seen in follicular lymphoma. In mantle cell lymphoma, you have translocation of 11-14. In Burkitt lymphoma, you basically have a translocation of a MYC, which is on chromosome 8, with either of the immunoglobulin loci. It could be kappa, lambda, or IgH. And then anaplastic large cell lymphoma is the one where it's not immunoglobulin related. It's translocation of chromosome 2 with 5. So now, we talk so much about lymphomas, and there are so many different types. How do you make sense of it? So classification is the language of medicine. So historically, you know, in the past, the pathologists did not have the benefit of advanced genomic profiling and such. So what you saw was what you got. So they just used to look at the microscope and they were like, all these cells look big, let's just put them in one bucket. All these cells look small, let's put them in one bucket. So the early classifications were pretty, like they didn't really make sense except to the pathologists. But slowly we've come a long way since then, and now what we've done is we're using the WHO classification, which is very good because it's universal, it's accepted as a standard in most countries. It combines not just the clinical picture and what we see under the microscope in pathology, but also the genetics of the cancer. So it makes sense on many levels. And it applies not just to, like, lymphomas have a different classification, leukemias have a different classification. It's a comprehensive classification of all hematopoietic neoplasms. There are actually more than 60 now in the latest classifications. There are a lot of different entities of lymphomas. In general, how we classify lymphomas, though, is you have non-Hodgkin lymphoma and you have Hodgkin lymphoma. In the non-Hodgkin lymphoma, you've got B-cell lymphomas and T-cell lymphomas. Now, this is the real classification, like all these different entities, which, I mean, like, probably not worth remembering because even as a lymphoma doctor, I might not see all of these entities in my whole career, but this is just to give you a sense of how complicated it is. Why is lymphoma important is because it is the seventh most common cancer in the United States. And in both men and women in 2017, and it is the ninth most common cause of death from cancers in the United States. I mean, absolute numbers may not be that high compared to some other cancers, but from a mechanistic point of view, it is very interesting because you can really use bench-to-bedside medicine and make a difference easily in lymphomas. So, now talking more about numbers, the most common type of lymphomas is, of course, non-Hodgkin lymphomas. About 90% of lymphomas are non-Hodgkin. 10% are Hodgkin. Among the non-Hodgkin, 85% are B-cell lymphomas, and rest 15% are T-cell lymphomas. Now, let me ask you this. The amount of B-cells and T-cells in the body are equal. But then why are B-cell lymphomas so common? T-cell lymphomas are so rare. And that's because if you remember, like, the development of B-cells, the B-cells undergo a lot of rearrangements in their chromosomes, like, at different phases. So there's a lot of chance for mistakes. So, like, first they undergo VDJ recombination, then they undergo somatic hypermutation, and then they undergo something called a class switch, which I didn't talk about. But then, like, so there are a lot of chances that something will go wrong, and they'll just take off from there. That's the reason why B-cell lymphomas are much more common. Risk factors. So anytime you are immunosuppressed, your immune system is not working well, like, you know, after a transplant, like a kidney transplant, when you're on medications to prevent rejection, you're at higher risk for lymphomas. Anytime when your immune system is revved up for any reason, like if you have lupus or any autoimmune condition, you're at more risk for lymphomas. Chronic infections like hepatitis C, hepatitis B, EBV, high risk for lymphomas. And radiation, again, because it introduces the risk, because it has more risk for mutations to occur. Clinical manifestations. So when do you suspect lymphoma? So because there are different so many types, there is not like one clinical manifestation. But in general, the patients could have like lymphadenopathy, their lymph nodes may be swollen, or they may just be feeling very sick, they may just be losing a lot of weight, or they might not even have noticed it. Somebody else notices it in their blood, like they may be totally asymptomatic. Sometimes when, you know, bone marrow is the factory where everything is made, and if it's being overwhelmed by lymphoma, it's just making lymphoma, then it may not have the chance to make the normal stuff. So you can get bone marrow failure. You can get anemia, low white count, or low platelets. Patients can present with that. The lymphomas can go through the central nervous system, your brain. Lymphoma patients can make antibodies, which cause, again, hemolysis or thrombocytopenia. If they're very close to, let's say, the ureters, they can block the flow of urine and cause kidney cause renal failure. They can compress the spinal cord and cause paralysis. It just depends on where the lymphoma is about, and that guides what symptom the patient might have. So how do you make the diagnosis? So what you need to do is, of course, what we do is we look at the patient, look at the symptoms. We run some laboratory tests. We do some imaging to see where the lymphoma is at. We do CAT scans and PET scans. And then the gold standard, you know, it'll tell you, okay, I suspect a lymphoma. But we have the saying in cancer that when tumor is the rumor, tissue is the issue. So you really need tissue to tell you what exactly it is. You need to look at it under the microscope. The usual test we do with a biopsy is look at it under the microscope and then do something called immunohistochemistry. Look at what proteins are expressed by the cells. The other way of looking at the proteins is flow cytometry. And then the latest and greatest is that you need cytogenetics. You need to look at the genetic makeup of the cancer. You need to look at what translocations might be there in the cancer for confirmatory testing. There are other things like gene expression profiling that you can do, but it's not used for clinical practice. But for research purposes, definitely, yeah. So let me give you an example. So I saw this 50-year-old man, previously healthy, who came with enlarging neck lymph node on the left side. Sorry, I didn't get a picture. Like, this is from the internet, and the lymph node is on the right side, but this guy had it on the left side. And he had lost a lot of weight, and he had drenching night sweats. He used to wake up every night with his body drenched in sweat. On exam, he had this lymph node. He had no other lymph nodes, no liver, spleen enlargement. So what do we do next? So I did a scan. Oh, I did a blood test, which showed that his LDH, lactate dehydrogenase, is high, which is kind of like a marker of how fast something is dividing. So that kind of tells me, 1 month history, high LDH, this looks like it's a high-grade lymphoma. And then the scan, this is a PET scan. A PET scan, what you do in a PET scan is you inject radio-labeled glucose, and you assume that if something is growing fast, it needs more glucose, so it'll light up on the PET scan. So the more yellow something is or the more black something is, the more active it is. So the PET scan showed that lymph node in the neck that I had noticed, but it also showed a lot of disease elsewhere. So now, you know, I'm thinking more, okay, it looks like a high-grade lymphoma. So then we go ahead and do a lymph node biopsy. We take a chunk of tissue out of the lymph node in the neck. So that, it shows these big cells. So I know that, okay, it's a large cell lymphoma. Now what I do is I apply the knowledge that we learned already, that let me look at the proteins on the surface of this cell. So remember I said CD20 is a B cell marker. So look at this. When they stained it with a CD20 stain, brown means positive. It's like all brown. So I know it's a B cell malignancy because it's CD20 positive. And then I want to know more, like which B-cell malignancy, it's a large cell. So I did a few stains like BCL2, CD10, BCL6, which kind of tells me that it's coming from the germinal center. So putting everything together, I know that it's a diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, which is a very aggressive B-cell lymphoma. So like till like 10 years back, that was all we had, okay. But now what we do is we go one step beyond and we look at the genetics of the cancer. So what we do is something called FISH, fluorescent fluorescent in situ hybridization. So when we did that, we saw that the patient has a c-myc translocation and the patient also has a BCL2 translocation. So now I know it's not just a garden variety diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, it's a high-grade diffuse large B-cell lymphoma with a, which is, we call it double hit. So, you know, typically for B-cell, for DLBCL, the treatment is R-CHOP, but this patient, we know, from looking at many patients that R-CHOP is not enough, so I really need to treat this patient with high-dose chemotherapy with probably a transplant, a stem cell transplant. So that's how marrying all these studies together helps me treat the patients. In contrast, let's look at this patient. 75-year-old man, he had another, same thing, he had a lymph node in his neck, but this lymph node has been growing for the past 2 years. He also noticed some swelling in his groin. But his labs are totally normal. And this is his PET scan. Again, I mean, it is lighting up in the neck, it's lighting up in the groin. But when I did his biopsy, I mean, this looks like a fairly well-preserved architecture for a lymph node, like nice-looking follicles, but there are just too many. And again, CD20 is positive, so I again know it's a B-cell lymphoma. But here, it looks like it's a low-grade B-cell lymphoma, again coming from the germinal center. Now, in this patient, translocation 14-18 was positive, and that's a hallmark of follicular lymphoma. So for this patient, my diagnosis was follicular lymphoma, grade 1 to 2, and the treatment is totally different. It's watchful expectancy. The life expectancy of these patients is years, even without treatment. So that's why you really need to kind of know all the pieces of the puzzle to know how you're, what are you going to do with the patient. So lymphoma biology is aggressive lymphoma, indolent lymphoma. Aggressive will kill you if you don't treat it, so you got to go ahead and do something for it now. But you can actually cure these lymphomas. Low-grade lymphomas, relatively good prognosis. These patients live for years. But the body is so in tune with these lymphomas that rarely you can cure them, but it's hard to get rid of these lymphomas. So now we know what lymphoma it is. But that's not enough, because remember, the immune system has so many moving parts. So you have to see where all has the lymphoma gone. What's the stage? So we use something called Ann Arbor stage for lymphomas, which is basically if it's in one spot, it's stage one. If it's in like 2-3 spots, but it's all above the diaphragm or all below the diaphragm, it's stage two. If it's both above and below, it's stage four, but it's still in the lymphatic organs. Now, if the lymphoma leaves the lymphatic organs and goes to the bone marrow, bone, or your liver, then it's stage four lymphoma. So, you know, I just put these three lymphomas for your purview. They are the three most common lymphomas: follicular lymphoma, diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, and Hodgkin's lymphoma. And they are kind of like the prototype for indolent lymphoma, high-grade lymphoma, and Hodgkin lymphoma is a totally different entity altogether. I'm just going to skip these slides because I already talked to you about, you know, the follicular lymphoma. Now, diffuse large B-cell lymphoma is very interesting. And that's because it's not just one disease. Depending on where these cells are coming from, the prognosis can be very different. So like I mentioned, the standard treatment is something called R-CHOP, which is basically a chemo cocktail. R stands for rituximab, which is the anti-CD20 monoclonal antibody. And CHOP is cyclophosphamide, adriamycin, vincristine, and prednisone. But based on the score called IPI, the prognosis of this lymphoma is very different in different patients. What is more interesting is, you know, we've been trying to improve the prognosis for these patients by, like, doing something to the R-CHOP, but nothing was working. But there was a big breakthrough in the year, like, 2001, where they did gene expression profiling for this diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, and they found that it's actually three major entities. It's ABC diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, GCB diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, and primary mediastinal diffuse large, not diffuse large, but primary mediastinal B-cell lymphoma. Why this is very interesting is because the ABC actually does not come from the germinal center. It comes from the immunoblast stage of the B-cell. The GCB stands for germinal center B-cell lymphoma. And the primary mediastinal B-cell lymphoma is totally different. And look at this. So this was the survival for patients with GCB, just with CHOP. And this was the survival of patients with ABC. So clearly there's a big divide, and that this is what is pulling the survival down. So we really need to try something different for ABCs. CHOP is probably not the best thing for these patients. And that's what a big focus of research, not just in the lymphoma community, but in our lab is, to see how we can improve the outcomes in patients with ABC, diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. So this is exactly what I told you just now, is to see how we can not just improve survivors in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma in general, but how we can like harness different pathways and like maybe try something which is not chemotherapy for these lymphomas, because clearly chemotherapy is not the best idea. Now, I want to talk briefly about Hodgkin lymphoma because it is very interesting. Of course, this is Dr. Hodgkin. And this was like an initial, like one of the early reports of Hodgkin lymphoma. It used to be this bad, which is not nowadays, thankfully. But Hodgkin lymphoma is very interesting because the real cancer cells are these tiny, these big cells called Reed-Sternberg cells. But these cells, like if there's a huge lymph node like in that kid, these cancer cells are only 5% of the whole lymphoma. And they're surrounded by these inflammatory cells, which are normal B and T cells. Like they are not cancer. So this fact has been known for years, but there was nothing we could do about it. So, and I mean, in general, the prognosis of Hodgkin lymphoma was very good with the standard chemotherapy, but there was a major breakthrough with immune checkpoint inhibitors. What was found is these Reed-Sternberg cells, genetically, they overexpress 9p24, which is basically the PD-L1 gene. So they have a lot of PD-L1 on their surface. The PD-L1 binds with the PD-1 on the tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes, and even though they're sitting there, they're kind of activated. They're kind of deactivated. They really can't go attack this cancer cell. So basically, this cancer cell has totally positioned itself in such a way that it's calling all these inflammatory cells, but then it's totally like neutralizing them. They can't do anything. So, but now we can do something about it. We have something called nivolumab, which is anti-PD-1 monoclonal antibody. So when they tried nivolumab for these patients, look at the response. Like, all the patients responded. Like, these are patients who were very relapsed and refractory Hodgkin lymphoma, where they had blown through chemotherapy, they were not responding to anything, they had seen a transplant, and then when you woke up the immune system by using nivolumab, boom, great responses. So this is like a great example of bench-to-bedside medicine, like how research in the lab really made a big difference for these patients. And now the thought process is, wow, it worked so good in patients who were so refractory, maybe we should use it upfront. And then maybe, like in the future, the dream is that maybe we'll not even need to use chemotherapy. We can just use these smart drugs and harness your own immune system and fight these cancers. So it's kind of like a practical way to think about lymphomas as indolent, aggressive, and very aggressive, and then Hodgkin lymphoma. Now, looking ahead, I'm just going to be very brief about it because I know Dr. Hernandez is going to talk more about the newer advances. But it is really exciting because, like I said, we are moving away from chemotherapy approaches and trying to see how we can use different pathways, different small molecules to fight cancer. And we have actually identified a lot of pathways which are mutated in different kinds of cancer. And we are using them to develop new therapies. For example, let's talk about ABC, diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, which I showed you has very bad outcomes. So this is the B-cell receptor, and this is the NF-kappa-B pathway. So what is found is that NF-kappa-B pathway, constitutive activation of this pathway, is the hallmark of ABC diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. So how they are connected is that the B-cell receptor activates Bruton tyrosine kinase, BTK, which goes forward and activates the NF-kappa-B pathway, which promotes transcription and survival. The other pathway that is activated by the B-cell receptor is the PI3 kinase AKT/mTOR pathway. The other pathway which is activated is the other key molecule is the MYD88. The other key part is the interferon pathway. This is inhibited by IRF4. Interferon causes cell death. So if you inhibit interferon, that gives the cells an edge to survive. And then the last piece of the puzzle is the JAK-STAT pathway, which also promotes survival in these cells. So the first step was to find out what's mutated in ABC DLBCL. So they found that mutations can occur here, CARD11, they can occur in MYD88, they can also occur here. So then, now we have all these targets which can attack at all these different levels and kill the cancer cell. The problem is the cancer cells are very smart. If you block one pathway, they can always compensate for the other pathway. So the struggle right now is to combine agents to see which will kind of annihilate the cancer from different angles, and also to make sure that the patient is alive while you do it. Like, you don't want to block any pathways which are necessary for survival and don't cause like really bad side effects. So one of the ways of doing it is monoclonal antibodies. There are all these different targets for monoclonal antibodies. We already have a monoclonal antibody for CD30, CD30, which is called brentuximab, CD20, rituximab, which is like the workhorse in the lymphoma, in treatment of lymphoma. We have more improved CD20 antibodies like ofatumumab and obinutuzumab. The other cool thing that we're using now is something called BiTE, bispecific antibodies. So, you know, like I just showed you the other antibodies like CD20 antibodies, but they don't really do much. They just find the CD20, bind to it, and then induce ADCC and CMC. And then it's like, okay, maybe what we can do is we can make two parts of the antibody. One of them recognizes the cancer. The other one calls to the T cells and says, hey, here's the CD9 positive cancer. Can you come and kill it? So that's what it does exactly. One side it calls, it binds to the T cell. The other side it binds to the cancer cell, and it causes T cell mediated killing of the cancer cell. Blinatumomab has already been approved for. Go ahead.
Yeah. Wouldn't the T cells need their T cell receptor activated by contact?
So what they found is that when the T cell comes in proximity of the cancer cell, it gets activated on its own. It's just the proximity of the T cell, that's proximity of the cancer that is needed. I mean, it doesn't work for all cancers precisely for that very reason, that some patients, they need more than that, and that's not enough. So, but you bring up a very good point, because an improvement over the BiTE technology is, it's coming, it's in the slide after this, but it's the CAR T cell therapy, which answers exactly that question that you need co-receptors to activate the T cell. So the other thing that has been used is something called antibody-drug conjugate. So it's the same concept. You use something like an anti-CD19 target, but you also add like a poison to it. So what has been added is something called a calicheamycin, which is or something called MMAE, which is an anti-microtubular agent. So what happens is that this is something called brentuximab. What happens is that the brentuximab delivers this poison called MMAE to the cancer cell. The MMAE is internalized, and the cell undergoes cell cycle arrest because it's arrested in the metaphase, and it dies. But, and there are all these other small molecules in development. But the latest and greatest, of course, are the CAR T cells, which answer the question of, you know, you're designing a perfect T cell, which is which you can direct towards a specific marker. So, how do you design a CAR T cell? You add a antibody-derived recognition moiety, like for the latest, the CAR T cell that is most further advanced in development is an anti-CD19 CAR. So that's what you do. You add an anti-CD19 moiety. You have a co-stimulatory domain, and depending on who's making the CAR, which company, the co-stimulatory domain varies. And then you have a T-cell activation domain. This is the chimeric antigen receptor. You insert it into a vector, which could be either a lentivirus or a retrovirus, and then you introduce into a T-cell, which is usually taken from the patient. Now, this T-cell expresses an anti-CD19 CAR, which can recognize and kill the cancer cell. So how it works is that you have the patient, you collect their T cells, you make them proliferate in vivo, ex vivo, and then you introduce the CAR, and then you introduce the T cell back into the patient. And this was the first report of CAR T cells in humans, where they tried it, I think, in around 27 patients with ALL. Of course, not all responded, but these ALL patients were kind of like almost about to die, so there were some patients that they could salvage with the CAR T cell therapy. And since then, we've had CAR T cells developed for many, many, many other conditions by different people. So, you know, in summary, what I would like to say is that lymphomas are very intellectually stimulating, difficult to treat because there are so many different types, but also very rewarding because you can really use bench-to-bedside medicine and you can really make a difference in many patients. I'd be happy to take any questions now, or we could wait for Dr. Hernandez to tell you what is the latest and greatest and upcoming. By the time you guys graduate, what will be new in lymphomas?
Hi guys, so do you guys have any questions for Dr. Torta, or should we go to the next one? Okay, so we're going to change a little bit to kind of tell you guys what we do in our program and where we're heading in terms of the research that we're working, you know, to kind of further advance therapy for patients with aggressive lymphomas. And, you know, in our laboratory program, you know, we are primarily have different projects, but one of the projects that we have that is the foundation of the research that we do in the clinics and in the laboratory is to try to understand why patients are failing current available treatments for aggressive lymphomas. As Dr. Torca mentioned earlier, the standard of care right now is using a combination approach that use monoclonal antibodies against CD20 and CHOP chemotherapy. Rituximab is, again, as she mentioned, is a chimeric antibody that binds to CD20. CD20 receptor is a very important receptor, at least from the therapeutic standpoint of view, because it's present in 80% of the B-cell lymphomas. It is not expressed in plasma cells, it's not expressed in stem cells. So when you actually administer rituximab to a patient, you deplete the B cells, but you don't deplete the progenitor cells, or you don't deplete the plasma cells, so patients eventually can reconstitute their immune system over time, and they don't have any increased risk of infections. Rituximab as a therapy itself is effective in indolent lymphomas, and is very effective when you combine it with chemotherapy drugs. Prior to rituximab approval by the FDA, we were only able to expect to cure around 35% of the patients with large B-cell lymphoma. Since the approval of rituximab and as we added to chemotherapy drugs, we do expect to cure around, you know, 65 to 70% of the patients, you know, with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. So that's good. It's a great advance. You know, certainly there have been 4 randomized clinical trials that proved that. But the way that we look at it is that while we can cure more patients, this curve is still kind of low. We would like to see the curve a little bit higher up. So the question is why patients are failing therapy, you know, and, you know, what is different in those patients and how can we target them? So in our laboratory, to try to study mechanisms of resistance to rituximab, we created cell lines that we have been using as a tool for our research. We took cell lines that they were sensitive to rituximab, and we exposed them to rituximab in different conditions, and over time the cells developed resistance to rituximab using immunological assays. Then we look at gene expression profiling, and we're trying to see what kind of genes were modified in those cells to try to understand what pathways were relevant. And this is something that we found out here, that these are kind of some of the genes that they were highly upregulated in patient, you know, in cell lines that they were resistant to rituximab. What was very interesting is that those cells, when they develop resistance to rituximab, you know, they also develop concomitant resistance to chemotherapy drugs. And this is one of the first kind of findings that suggests that there could be cross-resistant mechanisms of resistance between biological agents and chemotherapy drugs. This is something that we have been trying to focus on. So, if we go back to when we're looking at the genes that they were highly upregulated, you know, in resistant cell lines, we found out that there were several genes that they were mutated or changed. Some of them had to do with histone deacetylation or the ubiquitin protein system. But another set of genes that we didn't describe in this particular slide was looking at the apoptotic machinery of the cancer cells. So what we noticed was that rituximab chemotherapy-resistant cell lines, they actually deregulate the expression of BCL2 family members. What you can see in these Western blottings is just the pattern of expressions of different members of the BCL2 family members, and I'm going to show you a cartoon of how do they interact. And at the same time, we found some changes in what we call the inhibitory of apoptotic proteins. So what these kind of changes led to is really to reset into the apoptotic threshold of a cancer cell, meaning that you need to kind of stress the cell higher to kind of, you know, kill them, so to say. So this is a cartoon that kind of tell us the very fine balance between pro-apoptotic and anti-apoptotic proteins. We know that in a resting state, there is always a clear balance between proteins of the BCL2 family members that stimulate cell death and proteins that they prevent that. The net balance between these two opposite forces will maybe tilt the balance towards a cell under a stressful situation to die or not. The balance between these two proteins is further affected by what we call the BH3 single domain proteins, BAD, NOXA, BIM, BID, PUMA, but in reality there are 18 more that they are not highlighted in this cartoon that they have been identified over the last 20 years. And we know that these particular proteins, they have similar structure homology to BCL2 pro and anti-apoptotic proteins, you know, they actually can inactivate BCL2, MCL1 or other anti-apoptotic proteins to allow BAX and BAG to actually, you know, disrupt the mitochondria and release cytokine and induce apoptosis. BCL2 is actually one of the first abnormalities that was found in lymphoma to be upregulated. Again, Palau, we kind of mentioned about how BCL2 was found in follicular lymphomas, but it's also expressed in other types of lymphomas. So the deregulation and the abnormal expression of anti-apoptotic proteins or the decreased expression of pro-apoptotic proteins has been highlighted in many types of lymphomas, and it has been associated with a poor clinical outcome. So part of our work, and this is what I'm going to be focusing in today's presentation, is looking at how can we affect the mitochondrial potential in these cell lines to favor a pro-apoptotic environment. So that has been the whole. So we have a couple of projects that they have been moving in different phases. So we're going to be talking about how in the laboratory we use cell line models, animal models, primary tumor cells isolated from patients, and how those studies are leading into designing clinical trials for the future. So I'm going to be looking at how we use proteasome inhibitors to affect the apoptotic potential, how do we directly target BCL2 family proteins, how do we actually target EAP proteins, and most recently, and it will kind of come to sense, how do we alter the glucose metabolism, you know, as a way to actually stimulate the mitochondria to release cytokine C. So we kind of became very interested in looking at the proteasome as a tool to increase the apoptotic proteins, because we kind of found that, you know, one, while rituximab-resistant chemotherapy cells were resistant to rituximab and chemotherapy drugs, they were actually quite sensitive to proteasome inhibition. So this is basically what you have. So, you know, in contrast to other chemotherapy drugs that we were using against these cancer cells, proteasome inhibitors, and in this case it's bortezomib, it was as effective, you know, in whether you were a sensitive or a resistant cell line, you know. Now, what is very interesting here is in the second cartoon, we're looking at the pattern of protein expression after proteasome inhibition. This is a rituximab-sensitive cell line, and this is a rituximab chemotherapy-resistant cell line. And you can see that over time, you know, and this is very important, you know, when you look at BAX, BIG, and NOXA, you can see that over time in the resistant cell lines, BAX gets expressed, NOXA gets expressed, which is the term, you know, and then you can see PARP cleavage. PARP cleavage is basically the execution of apoptosis. So you can see that in a sensitive cell line, who has a normal levels of BAX and BAG, when you expose them to proteasome inhibitors, they go into apoptosis within 24 hours. But in a cell that is more resistant to it, that you need to block the proteasome, you know, to kind of stabilize BAG, you know, then you actually can see that, you know, you eventually kill the cell. We were actually the first group that we actually demonstrated that BAG is a substrate for proteasome degradation. So this actually was never described before. And we have been using, which is like a very simplified in the last column, looking at actually how do we use the proteasome inhibitors to resensitize cells to chemotherapy drugs. And this is a study in which you can show that you actually can resensitize cells to cisplatinum after you expose them to proteasome inhibition. That has led, and I don't think, yeah, that has led to us to kind of further study proteasome inhibitors in the management of patients with refractory large cell lymphoma. So we did an old clinical trial looking at bortezomib with low-dose chemotherapy, and again, it was not as successful as we wanted it, because unfortunately the patients were progressing very quickly before they were able to get a complete treatment plan. And I think part of it was because maybe we were using a weaker proteasome inhibitor. So this is actually work that we have been doing with novel proteasome inhibitors. The difference between the blue and the red line is depends on the proteasome. The blue one is bortezomib, which is the first generation proteasome inhibitor. The second one, which is the red, is carfisolid. Carfisolid is a an irreversible proteasome inhibitor versus bortezomib, which is reversible. And I can tell you that molar per molar, that actually is more potent, not only in sensitive cell lines, but in chemotherapy and rituximab-resistant cell lines. And in this particular table down here, we can pretty much look at the same kind of situation. It's just the amount of cell viability over time, you know, comparing, you know, bortezomib versus carfisolid. Then we look to see if we can use carfisolid to resensitize cells to chemotherapy drugs. So we have several panel of cells. These are looking at rituximab chemotherapy resistant cell lines, Burkitt's type, germinal center type, and activated B cell type. And then this is basically comparing bortezomib versus carfisolid. And then we're looking at etoposide as a chemotherapy agent too. And what we found is that, you know, you can certainly render cells more sensitive to etoposide if you combine it with either proteasome inhibitor. Similar situation, we kind of found combining it with carboplatinum. And again, why we're testing these two drugs is because carboplatinum and etoposide are drugs that have been used to treat patients who they have failed rituximab CHOP chemotherapy in the clinical setting. So that kind of led us to our current clinical trial that we have at the Institute, in which patients who they have refractory large B-cell lymphomas, they're actually being treated with carfisolid for 2 days before they actually get their rituximab and ICE chemotherapy. This is basically conducted for a total of 3 cycles, and then after that the patients go into an autologous bone marrow transplant. Our goal is that we're hoping to have a higher cure rate, so current therapy with rituximab, ICE chemotherapy, and a bone marrow transplant can only cure 30% of the patients with relapsed large cell lymphoma. So we're hoping that by adding carfisolid, we'll be able to actually, you know, cure more patients. But again, that's kind of remains to be seen. Again, but this is an example of how work that we have been doing for the last 10 years has been translated into 2 clinical trials. So with that in mind, I'm going to be moving at really blocking BCL2 family members, you know. So in the past, you know, we were kind of interested in silencing BCL2 family members. So we did a lot of preclinical studies looking at oligonucleotide antisense. And there have been a lot of experiments that we have conducted that if we knock down BCL2, you actually can render cells more susceptible to rituximab or chemotherapy drugs. And you actually can actually potentiate the effect of rituximab in vivo using lymphoma xenografts. The problem with antisense oligonucleotides, as we can see sometimes in medicine, is that what works very well in a mouse model sometimes doesn't translate into a clinical trial. So the studies with oligonucleotide antisense, unfortunately, they were not very successful because there was very erratic incorporation of the oligonucleotide antisense into the tumor cells in a human compared to a mouse or a cell line. You know. So to circumvent that, so several pharmaceutical companies that we have been working with them since the beginning have been designed what we call BH3 mimetics. So BH3 mimetics are basically compounds that they have similar homologies to the binding site, you know, of what we call the BH3 single domain proteins like NOXA, PUMA, BIM, and so on, you know, and therefore they basically bound with the BCL2 anti-apoptotic proteins, and they inhibit them. And what happened is that then those inactivated BCL2 anti-apoptotic proteins, then they allow BACs and BACs to oligomerize in the mitochondrial membrane and allow cytokine C to be released. So there is a cartoon that kind of show different compounds that they have been developed in clinical trials, and this one eventually was changed in formulation to ABT-199, which is now FDA approved to treat patients with refractory CLL. You know, but again, all of these compounds, they basically inactivate, you know, different members of the anti-apoptotic proteins, you know. And again, that kind of, depending on which compound we're using, it depends on the member that they block. Some of them, like NSC736630, which is also known as cosadolin, which was used as an contraceptive drug in China, is known to block all the apoptotic proteins. The other ones, which are being used in clinical practice, they block 3 out of 4 of the anti-apoptotic proteins. Depending on which one they block, it really has to do with how active the compound is and how toxic it can be. So at the very beginning, we became interested in studying obataclox. Obataclox was one of the first single domain BH3 mimetics that were developed. In this particular studies, you know, again, we're just kind of looking here, this cartoon, at the difference in the ratio of anti-apoptotic proteins, pro-apoptotic proteins and anti-apoptotic proteins in sensitive cells and resistant cells. And as you can see, you know, the ones who are basically in the black are the resistant cell lines. They tend to have basically very low levels of BACs, so the ratio is a little bit abnormal. Those cells, of course, certainly, you know, they have a very resistant mitochondrial potential, which is what we measured in this particular experiment with a dye. But what we found is that these cells are quite sensitive, you know, to BH3 mimetic inhibition with the obataclox. And I think that's, you know, and technically, if you use a caspase inhibitor, you don't rescue those cells. So that kind of suggested that this particular compound was triggering cell death in a caspase-independent manner, which was kind of surprising because we would think that BCL2 family members are supposed just to work within the mitochondrial range. This is just a dose sensitivity curve that you can see that whether you are chemosensitive or chemoresistant, the compound works. It does potentiate rituximab activity, you know, so these are escalating doses of the compound. So what we found out is that, you know, depending on the BACs or BAC expression of the cell lines, you actually can trigger 2 different kinds of cell death. And these are electron microscopy photographs that we can look at DMSO control or the obataclox exposure. This is basically a sensitive cell that has BACs and BAC expression. And you can see that you have seen features very similar to what we see with apoptosis, which is a condensation of the nuclei. Now, when you look at a cell that is deficient of BAC and BAC, you don't see apoptosis. You do see cell death, as you can see in this column or here, but the death is mediated by induction of autophagy, and that's why you see this BAC walls formation. So again, you know, it's very interesting because it kind of further allows to kind of understand how these particular compounds, they work. They do work by affecting the interaction of BACs or BAC if BAC is expressed. But it can also kill cancer cells if they have low levels of BACs. Now, one of the challenges with BCL2 inhibitors, at least with obataclox when it was taken into clinical practice, is that we were seeing significant amount of neurotoxicity. And because of that, the drug was not further pushed into clinical trials. So that led us to study ABT-737 and eventually ABT-199. So ABT-737 was a similar compound. It was bounding to different BCL2 family members, and we found the same phenomena, which meaning that you can potentially rituximab activity, you can kill these cancer cells. And eventually ABT-199 was actually approved by the FDA, as I said before, to treat patients with CLL. Now, when ABT-199 was actually taken into trials to see if it was active in other type of lymphomas, unfortunately, the activity was not as strong. And people were trying to figure out, well, how come it works in CLL and it didn't work in large cell lymphoma? And one of the reasons has to do with expression of MCL1. So when we look at what proteins ABT199 inactivates, ABT199 primarily inactivates BCL2, BCL-xL, and A1, but it doesn't affect MCL1. Whereas Ovataclox does inhibit MCL1, but it was too toxic to be moved forward into clinical trials. So this is a collaboration that we did with Dr. Lenz in Germany, that we were looking to see what is the clinical effect of MCL1 in patients with large cell lymphomas. And again, we can see that MCL1 is overexpressed primarily in patients of the activated B-cell lymphomas, which is something that we kind of mentioned during her talk, that those are the ones that they tend to be more resistant to chemotherapy drugs, you know, and that's another way that we can look at the difference. And we know that if we knock down MCL1 using sRNA technology in different cell lines, you can decrease viability. The viability primarily was observed in ABC type of lymphoma. The kind of reddish colors are germinal center lymphomas. The one in bluish colors are usually ABC, you know, ABC large cell lymphomas. We kind of further, you know, kind of suggest that if you knock down MCL1, you actually can potentiate the effect of chemotherapy drugs. So you can do an argument that the most important protein to target in large cell lymphoma within the BCL2 family members is MCL1. Currently, there are pharmacological inhibitors of MCL1 that are undergoing preclinical testing and early phase 1 clinical trials, you know. At the Institute, what we decide to do is that, you know, well, how can we optimize ABT199 when MCL1 inhibitors are not there yet? So one of the things that we saw early in our studies was that when you expose lymphoma cells to progressive inhibitors, MCL1 levels go down. You know, that's an effect that we see with every progressive inhibitor. So what we decided to do is, why don't we use carfilzomib as a way to knock down MCL1 levels, and then we can maybe kill more cancer cells. So in these kind of experiments, we look at double hit large B-cell lymphomas because they are the most chemotherapy resistant cells. Those are the ones who they actually overexpress BCL2, CMYK, and, you know, MCL1. And again, you can see that, and again, when you look at the colors, the red very much is antagonism, but the green and the blue are synergistic activity. And again, so when we look at different cell lines, you know, we see synergy, you know, when you combine carfilzomib with ABT199. Currently, we're actually doing in vivo animal studies with this particular combination. And again, if this is actually a positive signal, then we'll take this further into a clinical trial. So I want to move forward to what we call inhibitory of apoptotic proteins, you know. So this is a very complicated slide, but it's an old one. And it just kind of tells you how, what happened after. So as we were kind of studying how BH3 single domain proteins, BACs, and BCL2 family proteins interact, the end result is that the mitochondria will release cytochrome C and will trigger apoptosis. However, there is a further checkpoint that can be blocked to prevent cell death, which is basically the inhibition of caspase activation. And that is usually controlled by what we call a family of proteins that are known as inhibitory of apoptotic proteins. I know we talked about briefly about how we use oligonucleotide antisense to block to decrease BCL2, how do we use the BH3 single domain proteins. So now we're going to be talking about how do we target ER proteins. So ER proteins, as I said before, there are 8 proteins that they have been identified, you know. They basically have the capacity and sequester caspases, you know. They technically have been expressed in lymphomas, and they have been associated with poor outcomes in different type of lymphomas like large cell lymphomas and Hodgkin's lymphomas. There is an inhibitor that we have been working with, but there are actually now 3 ERP inhibitors being studied in clinical trials. This primary compound is known as LCL161. It's an inhibitor of XIP and CIP, which are 2 of the 8 IP proteins. We did a quick dose curve looking at how these particular proteins, this particular compound can kill lymphoma cells. It can potentiate the effect of cytarabine, which is a chemotherapy drug that we use in the second line setting for aggressive lymphomas. And what is interesting is that we kind of further test into a lymphoma xenograft model. So we did this in two type of models. We did one in a rituxan chemotherapy sensitive lymphoma mouse model and one in a rituxan chemotherapy resistant mouse model. So in this one, what we use regular Raji cells, which are Burkitt's lymphoma cells, and we treat the animals with control, the YAP inhibitor, or chemotherapy and rituxan with or without the YAP inhibitor. And of course, because these are chemosensitive, the chemotherapy cocktail was able to cure all the animals, so the LCL161 effect was not, relevant, so to say. And this is something that we expected, because these cells, they have a very easy mitochondrial potential to kind of trigger apoptosis. But when you look at the chemotherapy-resistant mouse models, then you actually can see that by adding LCL1 to the chemotherapy, you actually can improve the outcomes compared to just the chemotherapy alone. So again, so this is data that, we're trying to publish the data. Eventually, this is something that we want to further take into clinical trials to kind of, maybe adding this new kind of compound, maybe rescue patients who are chemotherapy resistant. Now, this is another kind of interesting experiment. As I said before, there are 8 YAP proteins. LCL1 is supposed to bind to some. But the question we have been trying to figure out is which YAP protein is the most important one. So, because the problem is that every tissue will have YAP proteins. So if you use a pan inhibitor, most likely you will have more toxicity. So the more that you narrow the one that you think is more important, the chances are you will find a drug that maybe is less toxic. So Kyle Runkel, which is one of our grad students, so a lot of the work that has been that we're showing here is being done by our grad students who have been in the laboratory now or for the last 10 years. So this is work that people like you will be doing. So in this particular study, he was knocking down one by one each of the XIAP proteins. And none of them was really kind of affecting the viability of the cells until he knocked down XIAP. And you can see here that you can show that you actually can knock down XIAP, This is the scramble control. And when you knock it down, you can see that the cells die immediately. So we have been on the search of very specific XIAP inhibitors. So we know that Bristol Myers Squibb has one of them. Unfortunately, the preclinical studies with the dogs led to significant hepatotoxicity and liver failure. So this is one of the situations in which, you try to study a pathway, you find an inhibitor, but then you have to be practical about whether the inhibitor will be used or not in patient care, So going to back here, this is another study looking at the knockdown of XIAP, kind of for the potential effect of chemotherapy drugs like etoposide or gemcitabine. And this is basically looking at XIAP knockdown, and this is looking at the scramble. So you can clearly say that, knocking down XIAP reverse chemotherapy resistant. The question is, how do you get to use an XIAP inhibitor without major hepatotoxicity? And we can argue that maybe combining this kind of inhibitor in the context of an antibody that you can use to deliver the drug into the cancer cells could be a way to bypass the problem, Finally, I want to switch to blocking exokinase 2. And this is something that is very interesting, and it does have something to do with the mitochondria, even if it appears that it doesn't. So I'm pretty sure you guys have been looking at how there's in medicine something we call the Waldenström phenomena, in which as cancer cells develop more and more resistant to drugs, and as they live in more anaerobic conditions, they shift your metabolisms, to an anaerobic metabolism to kind of, produce energy. So when you change into an anaerobic metabolism, you primarily require glycolysis to produce ATP. Because when you look at protein and lipid catabolism, you remember biochemistry, lipid and protein catabolism only generates NADPH. And NADPH has to go to the mitochondria to be transformed into ATP. So the problem is, if you have a disruptive mitochondria, which a lot of chemotherapy-resistant cells have, then they do depend on ATP that has to be produced outside the mitochondria. And the only way that you can produce that is by glycolysis. So a lot of cancer cells, they do depend on glycolysis to generate ATP. But, you know, and that's what, one of the reasons that a lot of doctors look at glucose metabolism in cancer cells. To us, besides this, when we look at the pathway of glycolysis, we know that exokinase 2 is a very important player in the metabolic pathway of glucose, because it's the first enzyme that will phosphorylate glucose to glucose 6-phosphate, so it will prevent the glucose from exiting the cell. But at the same time, exokinase is actually sitting in the mitochondrial membrane, and it further interacts with Bax and BCL2 family members and actually prevents cytochrome C release. So exokinase, as an enzyme, it has two functions. One of them is to regulate the glucose metabolism, and the second one is to kind of be a barrier to the release of cytochrome C. So we kind of started this small project that eventually became a little bit bigger when we were looking at, it was an observation that a postdoc in the laboratory found, that he was looking at, when you culture cells in the laboratory, you will find out you have a pH indicator in the media that will change when the pH is changing, and that means that you have to feed the cells. So what she found out is that the chemotherapy-resistant cell lines, they were kind of changing the pH indicator of the media faster than the normal cells. But when you were measuring the proliferation of the cells were not proliferating that fast. So she was trying to figure out, well, why, if the cells are not multiplying that fast, why they are consuming the pH indicator faster? It has to do because they are producing more lactic acid, you know, into the media, you know. And what she noticed is that she was looking first at different metabolic parameters that we have here. So looking at mitochondrial potential, ATP production, and glucose consumption. And these are three pairs of cell lines. These are rituxan sensitive, rituxan chemotherapy resistant, rituxan sensitive, rituxan chemotherapy resistant. These are rituxan sensitive, and these are rituxan but not chemotherapy resistant cell line. And what she can notice that in the cell line that they have a higher glucose consumption and higher ATP production and a higher mitochondrial potential, they were the ones who they're resistant to both chemotherapy and rituxan drugs. Not surprisingly, they have a higher production of ATP, you know. And again, when you were trying to figure out where, you know, where is, you know, say, again, this is another way to look at the mitochondrial potential using an inhibitor, you know. You can say that, you know, again, those cells that were slightly more resistant to be killed compared to, you know, the sensitive cells. So then we start looking at, you know, if the glucose metabolism is slightly high, then we're looking at the exokinase 2 expression. And you can see that the cells that they were chemotherapy resistant or rituxan resistant, they had higher levels of HK2 expression. This is by messenger RNA. You know, this is when we're looking at protein expression, you know. And again, this is looking at HK2 expression based on whether you're in the cytoplasm or the nuclei. But again, for the most part, you know, it's in both, but even in the mitochondria, you can see a higher expression of HK2, you know. When we're looking at other compartments, which is BDAC, we see like there was a decrease in, you know, BDAC production. BDAC is another protein that is somehow favors apoptosis and interact with HK2 in the membrane of the cell, you know. So when we try to look at, you know, the mitochondrial potential and the HK2 ratio against the BDAC, we know that the ones who are super resistant are the ones who they have a high mitochondrial potential because they have higher expression of AK2 and less expression of BDAC. You know, and again, you know, when we look at them trying to block HK2, you know, so we basically start doing some experiments looking at first 2D glucose, which is just basically blocking the glucose metabolism, and you can see we're looking at mitochondrial potential, ATP generation, and viability. And you can see that in the resistant cell lines, you know, you certainly can decrease, you know, doing 2D glucose was certainly kind of lethal for these cells. And again, you know, when we look at combining with chemotherapy, you can do an argument that, again, chemotherapy in the sensitive cell lines was effective, you know, But when you do the 2DG, for example, this is just the chemotherapy alone. You don't kill the cells, but if you block glucose uptake, you can sensitize the cells to the chemotherapy drug. You know? So that's something that we cannot find in this particular experiment. Then we use a different inhibitor of exokinase 2. So that was just basically by giving the 2D glucose. This was looking at lonidine, which is an inhibitor of HK2, you know. And again, as you can see, lonidine was toxic to the cells, you know, in the three parameters that we were measuring. And it can actually further potentiate to a certain degree the effects of doxorubicin, you know. But again, that was not it was not as significant, to be honest. You know. Then, you know, when we look at exokinase 2 has a catalytic domain and a binding domain. The catalytic domain in important was tested with lonidine and the 2DG. The binding domain is the one that is bounding to the BDAC and BACS and BAC and all the other properties in the membrane. So we did experiments looking at a peptide that binds to HK2 in the binding domain. And you can basically see that, you know, when we're looking at, you know, different cell lines, the binding domain kind of, you know, further decrease the viability of lymphoma cell lines, you know, and technically it potentiates the effects of chemotherapy drugs, you know. So you can see that there is, you know, better, you know, activity, you know. Suggesting that you need both. You need to block the catalytic domain and you need to block the binding domain. Metformin is actually a drug that is known to decrease exokinase 2 expression primarily by downregulating mTOR activity. It's a weak mTOR inhibitor. So you can see that when you expose cells to metformin, you decrease HK2 expression, you know, for the most part, in most of the cells. And you can see that, again, in some cell lines, you actually decrease the viability of the cells, not in all of them. And, you know, in these three parameters, mitochondrial potential, viability, and ATP generation. So then we look at patients that we treated here at the Institute with rituximab and CHOP chemotherapy, and we look at three kind of patients. One of them were basically patients who they were not diabetics, so they were just getting rituximab and CHOP. Then we look at diabetics, so they were getting insulin or other oral hypoglycemic agents during chemotherapy, and then patients that they were diabetics getting metformin during the rituximab and CHOP. And you can look here the progression-free survival and the overall survival. And you can see that using metformin during your rituximab CHOP chemotherapy was associated with a better outcome. This was retrospective data. This is not a prospective clinical trial, so this was just a clinical observation. You know, this is a little bit kind of clean up the data, just looking at diabetic patients. And you can see that using metformin really kind of improved the outcomes. Through a collaboration with Fudan University, we're going to be conducting, and we're actually in the final stage of conducting a clinical trial randomizing patients to R-CHOP plus minus metformin in patients with large cell lymphoma. We'll conduct the study in China because it's a little bit easier and financially feasible, you know. So this is another experiment in which we're trying to basically silence HK2, you know, and kind of notice that, you know, by silence, you know, HK2, you decrease glucose consumption, you know, you decrease mitochondrial potential, and you decrease viability and enhance chemotherapy sensitivity. This is just the experiment that we confirmed the knockdown of HK2 in the cell lines using sRNA. Now, this kind of led us to kind of think about it. If HK2 is a viable marker of outcomes, so we collaborate again with Dr. Lenz in Germany, who they have a large repository of gene expression profiling studies done in patients treated with CHOP chemotherapy or rituximab CHOP with large cell lymphomas. So we're looking at, in this particular slide, we're looking at patients that they were treated with rituximab CHOP in a clinical trial. And out of these patients, they had tumor biopsies taken and frozen. And years ago, they did all gene expression profiling. So we went back to the database and interrogate those high levels of HK2 affect the outcomes or not, and the answer is yes. If you have high expression of HK2, you have basically, I would say, like a 15% less chances to be cured, you know. This was progression-free survival. Then we look at overall survival, and there are two cohorts of patients. The first cohort of patients here is the patients that were treated with CHOP chemotherapy, you know, and these are the patients that were treated with rituximab CHOP chemotherapy. So this again, you know, it looks like, you know, HK2 is a viable, and I think that's the, is a viable target for further drug development. And again, this is just a cartoon that kind of exemplifies what do we think is different between a sensitive cell line and a resistant cell line that has basically a higher levels of HK2, maybe less levels of BDAC, and that leads to basically an increased mitochondrial potential. Right now, what we're trying to do is to develop an inhibitor that blocks, that affects the binding domain, but at the same time will affect the catalytic function. The problem with, you don't want to block the catalytic function of HK2 directly because there are four isoforms of exokinase 2, and a lot of them are preserved and basically present in heart muscles and liver and so on. So, but what is very unique about exokinase as an enzyme is that if you affect the tertiary structure of the binding domain by binding an inhibitor, you can change how the catalytic domain may function. The binding domain is not preserved, so it's different from each isoform. So technically, you can develop an inhibitor that bounds to the binding domain and affect the tertiary structure of the entire protein, rendering the catalytic domain inactive. And this is what we're trying to partner with some chemists so we can actually further advance this project. So again, this is just a summary that we have been accomplished so far, you know. And again, this is just a very small pie of what everyone is doing in lymphoma therapy, you know, and how we're basically trying to understand and isolate patients who they are more resistant to current treatments, and how can we dissect pathways that they may are relevant, and then partner with, you know, institutions and industry to kind of test new inhibitors and put it back into the clinic, you know. So, and with this, I think I would like to take, yep, I would like to stop and take questions if you guys have some. Any questions? No? Okay. Thank you, guys. Mm-hmm. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Well, I
think that's very important. I think to me what will be more important for you in the exam is to really kind of understand to me the most important thing is to understand how the mitochondrial related proteins favor apoptosis or not. So rather than focusing on the inhibitors, rather than focusing on the experimental design, I think it's for you it's more important to be very well aware of two things. One is how does BCL2 family interacts with each members, and how do they interact with cytochrome C and other related proteins to favor apoptosis. And two, I think really to understand glucose metabolism in the context of cancer. I think to me that's the most important part of it. Again, because the rest, as I say before, these are projects that we're doing for you guys to know what the field is moving. But in reality, 10 years from now, maybe something different, you know. Okay.